So first of all, thank you for stopping by the Sioux Falls studio. What's it like to be home?
A day in South Dakota is much better than a day in Washington, D.C. I actually liked the job the first 8 or 9 months a little more than I thought I would. Yeah. The last 2 or 3 months of this year has maybe not been as rewarding.
Okay, but let's start at the beginning, because really from the first day that you arrive in Congress, there are some freshman lawmakers who are already talking about impeachment, who have been voted in largely in districts that the president had won before, and they come with something to say. That so in those early conversations you and I were having, we were talking about some of those folks, and then that sort of faded away, and you saw the Democrats kind of fracture a little bit and then unite over impeachment. So from your perspective, you're part of this freshman class as an incoming Republican. How much buzz was there in the very beginning for impeachment that overshadowed other things, or did that build to where you really only saw it in the last 2 or 3 months?
Well, there are really 3 incoming freshman classes. I mean, there are 90 of us, and so that's a very, very large freshman class. And when you think about the impact that can have on the culture of a place, I mean, you almost have 1/4 of Congress, you know, thrown out and replaced with a bunch of newbies. And by 3 freshman classes, I mean, you've got about 30 Republicans. And, you know, we're, of course, not a monolith, right? But I think we don't have the same kind of internal fracturing that the Democratic freshmen do. So then you've got 2 freshman classes. And the largest bulk of them are not Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez friends or confederates or partners, right? She kind of leads a coalition. People care a lot and have some very strongly held opinions and frankly have been driving a lot of the narrative. But a much larger portion of the Democrats are more moderate and are people that just have these resumes that would blow you away. I mean, Mikey Sherrill, our nation's first Navy combat pilot. Abigail Spanberger, our career CIA agent. Alyssa Slotkin, a former deputy undersecretary for state and a former high executive official in the National Security Council of President Bush. And in that way, if you were going to do a story, if NPR was going to do a story on the Democrat freshman women, so often they made that story about Ilhan Omar or AOC. They're a much smarter part of that class than, frankly, some of the others I'm mentioning.
All right. So you have to come, those people that you mentioned and yourself, you have to learn, you have a learning curve. Some of those people have said publicly, you know, I was not a legislator ever before. So I'm learning constituent relations. I'm learning legislation. I'm thinking about reelection because this is the nature of what we're doing. What was that transition like for you as far as the learning curve?
There was not as much of a learning curve as I expected. Now, as I think we've talked about before, some of my colleagues did come in with, you know, in essence, no government experience, as you alluded to. I mean, Kim Schreier, who's a friend of mine, had been a pediatrician for 35 years. So she's really an expert in some things, but parliamentary procedure wouldn't have been one of them, right? How the Small Business Administration works or Veterans Affairs works, that wouldn't have been in her wheelhouse. And those policy type things were more in my wheelhouse. I also had, both in my time in business and in my time in government, had a number of really smart, dedicated people who I knew I liked working with. So we staffed up very quickly. And I don't care how good you think you are, if you're in Congress and you view it as a one-person event, you're going to fail. I mean, you have to have a great team of people who share values and are willing to work hard. We hit the ground running because of those people. And I think it put us in a position to have some leadership roles that are not normally given to freshmen. I mean, being the floor manager for major pieces of Native American legislation, being named the ranking member of the committee that oversees food stamps, just these things that you don't normally get an opportunity to do in your first year in Congress.
You also come from South Dakota without necessarily a great mandate to do one thing. This was a state that voted for Trump strongly. Mm-hmm. They voted for you strongly. Do you have a sense of, you know, I need to think about reelection, but I'm not being driven by reelection like maybe some of these other people are perceiving that they really need to be. They were sent here to do something, and now they better do it.
Yes, I think, and I don't even know that the voters that sent Rashida Tlaib to Washington, they don't think with a single mind either. I mean, clearly Rashida, who's one of these, the squad we talk about, and she was one that was very vocal in sometimes profane terms about wanting to get rid of the president. And so she had strongly held opinions on that thing and talked a lot about that thing. I don't know that her voters were a monolith on that point, though, right? And so what I've tried to remind myself is, you know, South Dakota is very diverse. Every congressional district has a fair amount of diversity, right? And what we want to do is try to be effective in more than just one dimension, right? We've got farmers, that matters. We've got educators, that matters. We've got people who have disabilities, that matters. We're trying to fight back on these terrible, you know, terrible tragedies of suicide. I mean, there are 100 things we can be working on. Mm-hmm. And so on one hand, we have to focus. Particularly in the House, you don't get to do 100 things effectively. You got to pick 2 or 3 or 4 if you really want to have an impact. But at the same time, in a very broad sense, we need to try to be a customer, a citizen-focused agency where we're helping people navigate this incredibly large federal government that sometimes doesn't take care of their unique situation. And I think all things considered, we've done a really good job of that.
And that's a really effective point. I think that even South Dakotans are not monolithic voters.
Right.
Give me an example of, you know, a day in the life or a week in the life. What, how different are when people reach out to your office, whether they need help with something or whether they're providing feedback on something, is there consensus? Is that even a word that you would attempt to use about different topics that how South Dakotans feel like? Did you know how South Dakotans felt about impeachment, or is we're not a monolith either?
We are clearly not a monolith, and you can build a lot of common ground in South Dakota if you're willing to get out and about. I mean, I think if you only sit back in the office and listen to the phone calls, you have a sense that everybody is furious. And that half the people who call think President Trump is a terrible human being who needs to be thrown out of the office immediately. The other half think that he is, you know, a savior that has, you know, been really sent here, you know, by God to improve the country. And you have a very polarized sense if you just sit in your office and listen to the phone calls. If you actually get out and you go to the Black Hill Stock Show and you go to the Swim Empire Fair and you go to a ball game and you go help people, if you go deliver Meals on Wheels, and if you really are a part of the community, you understand that most of us are pretty conflicted about these big issues of the day. Mm-hmm. And even if we have strongly held worldviews, we understand that there's got to be a little give and take in a lot of these policy situations. And we have a sense that things are complicated. And that's why we send people to Washington. We want them to have our values. We want them to do their homework. We want them to be honest and hardworking. But that somebody's got to read the 2,000-page bill. It ain't going to be me because I just got done working a back-to-back shift at the convenience store. And now I got to help my kid with the science project.
Right.
And so we're not a monolith either, but you can build a lot of common ground.
Right. So as we get closer to the impeachment hearings, and then the inquiry in the House and then the debate on the House floor, how does the tone sort of change in Washington? What's your behind the scenes? Because this is this is history happening, unfolding, and maybe when you first were elected, you weren't planning on being at the center of this historic American story.
Impeachment clearly changed the tone, and I think it changed the pacing of work in Congress. For the first 8 or 9 months, as I, you know, started the segment saying, I was pleasantly surprised by D.C. I mean, the place doesn't work like it should, but it is still a place like, you know, Falkton or Brookings or Sioux Falls or, you know, Spearfish, where hard work does manifest itself in some positive outcomes. And so I was, you know, able to pass legislation, and I was able to be on the whip team for important, you know, bills. I was able to help people. I mean, we were moving the needle on a number of things. The last 2 or 3 months, there was more of a pall. There was more of a shadow. There was a gravity or a weight. It was harder to go from hearing people say really impassioned, sometimes rude things to an hour later trying to figure out a way forward with them on what a labor enforcement provisions of USMCA look like.
Mm-hmm.
And so it did, in a serious way, arrest some policy development in the last quarter or two of the year. And there are many prices to be paid anytime you engage in political battles, but that's one of them. I mean, there are things, I think, like prescription drugs, that there is no excuse why we didn't get that done in 2019.
You saw a lot of people sort of grappling with, a lot of congressmen and congresswomen grappling with the gravity of the phone call itself from one perspective or the other. Do you think that by the phone call, I'm referring to President Trump's phone call with the Ukrainian president, which is at the center of the impeachment, did you think when you first heard about, I mean, as you looked into it before all the noise, mm-hmm. you have a moment where you're just evaluating as a person, what do I think of this? What were some of your early impressions about, not again, how you voted and how, you know,
sure.
not that far down the line, but some initial impressions. Did you think it was wrong?
Well, I was surprised that this was the situation that I think launched this final chapter of this impeachment issue. And that's not to say that call was handled as I would have handled it. I mean, clearly, I think, you know, there are phrases that the president would like to claw back if he had an opportunity to. You know, he's also got kind of he's got a really interesting way of talking in person. It is incredibly casual and informal and kind of jocular and not really as lasered as most, particularly international conversations, are. So he's got a drastically different way of talking. And that's why I think the context around this does matter. I mean, I think there's one set of context where you can, if you wrap that around the call, you can think, well, that's, you know, that's not that bad. There's a different context you can wrap around that call where you can say, well, that is problematic. And I think that's what we've been fighting about is trying. I mean, the call on its own is not dispositive for me. You want to have an environment where you kind of understand, well, exactly what was meant and exactly what happened after that. But regardless of all that, I am surprised that this was the issue that I think brought us to this point.
Mm. So we get closer to the point where you get to get up and have your say during the actual debate. And we all know how you're going to vote because you were open on what you were thinking. And we know sort of what's happening here in South Dakota. So there wasn't a big, how will Congressman Dusty Johnson cast his vote? But you do have to make decisions. Mm-hmm. Did you decide what you were going to say on your own? Did you know what other people were going to say first? How did that sort of give us the inside scoop on how that was sort of planned? Or was it all organic and people just came and said what they had to say?
Well, for us, it was pretty organic for me, for our team. I didn't think I was going to get on the floor. I was 15th on the waiting list. And, you know, those slots went pretty quickly, and we were just a little slower to respond to the email. You know, there are certain people were going to get time to speak no matter what. You know, people on the judiciary or oversight or intelligence committees were going to get longer periods of time to kind of lay out the factual or political basis for their votes. You know, when you're dealing with 435 members, everybody who wants a couple of minutes, you were not, that's 15 hours. I mean, we did not have 15 hours of debate. We had close to a third of that. So I didn't know that I was going to get on. I was there on the floor for a good chunk of the day because I was interested in trying to take in as many perspectives as I could. And then finally they said, well, Dusty, if you're ready, go. And I said, well, geez, how long do I have? And they said, well, we think we can give you 30 seconds. Now, I mean, I'm not a fan of the 30 seconds because I just don't know if you can impart any real wisdom in 30 seconds. And so rather than try to relitigate all of the issues, rather than try to have a conversation about whether or not removing somebody from office is the appropriate sanction for what happened, I just thought it, because I'd been sitting there for a few hours, I thought, I'm going to say something that nobody else has said today. And that is that we got to be better tomorrow than we have been the last few months. Mm. And that's not the kind of comment that is going to make you famous on, you know, any of the cable news networks. You know, you're not going to lead, you're not going to be the lead story that night. And there's not much of a constituency or a coalition around decency. But a lot of my colleagues were listening and said something to me afterwards.
That was what I was going to ask you next. Who are you speaking to at that point? Your colleagues, us back at home, history? Who's your audience?
Oh, probably, and I don't want to seem egocentric, but probably first and foremost myself. I mean, so much of the system we all have rewards rancor. And most people, by the time they get to Congress, they become experts at adjusting to an environment right? Well, maybe I don't agree with this political science professor's views, but if I, you know, write the paper this way, I know I can get the A. Well, this boss wants me to clean the floor differently than I've ever cleaned the floor, but if I clean it this way, you know, the boss will like me better. I mean, we're really good at adapting to an environment and being successful. And so the problem for me is, as somebody who wants to be successful in an environment, what do I do when all of the incentives and disincentives in the environment are the wrong incentives? How do I keep myself from just playing to those incentives? And I periodically have to give myself a pep talk about, it is not about having the most Twitter followers, because I never will. And it's not about getting the most invitations to speak on cable news, because I never will. And it's not about having 100% approval rating with any particular constituency or narrow slice of the electorate, because I never will. Because I won't have a voting record that is just, you know, that is just a bumper sticker slogan. I mean, there are nuances to this. We need to care about the facts. And so I try to give myself the pep talk. And I think more than anything, I was just trying to remind myself that, you know, tomorrow I got to get back to work.
Yeah. Because there's a point where I'm watching the impeachment hearings live, and you are sitting behind, you know, because you have you're right in the front row, and I think it's Congressman Johnson from Ohio who has the moment of silence. Everybody stand, a moment of silence for the voters of the 2016 election, which he was criticized frequently later for the sort of grandstanding. I mean, is this an appropriate use of a moment of silence? And I was watching you, of course, because you're my congressman. You put your pen in your jacket and you adjust your glasses and you stand with everyone else. But all I could think of is, like, what a difficult position to be in. You can't stay seated. Right? I mean, what would that look like? But then you stand up and it's this moment that maybe you approved of, maybe you disapproved of. Do you remember that moment and what was going through your head?
I do. I mean, I have lots of strongly held opinions, right? I mean, I've never been accused of being a wallflower. I'm not milquetoast. I mean, I think one of the things that people appreciate and one of the things that gets me in trouble is I really do know what I believe, right? But I have been coached through, you know, 20 years of marriage to a really delightful and insightful human being that, you know, I don't need to try to impose my views on people all the time. And part of being a good leader is knowing when to use language that's de-escalating. And I, understanding that we still have to govern a country, even if I'm furious at my 230 colleagues who voted differently than I did on impeachment, if I want to get anything through the House, if we want to improve this country in any way through legislation, I've got to work with them. There is no mathematical way to get anything done without being willing to build a consensus in the United States House, the United States Senate, and with the White House. So for people say they just refuse to work with the president, well, that means you won't get anything done. You're not going to override his veto, right? There has to be a time when we're willing to work together. So throughout this impeachment process, although I've had strongly held opinions, I've also tried to use language that doesn't escalate the tensions. We still have a board of directors that has to meet. And that sometimes means, you know, not speaking up, not getting angry. When getting angry doesn't help.
Is that same kind of rhetoric off camera too? Are people that impassioned and fired up about it? Or is it something that by and large the cameras are influencing because everyone knows, you know, you only get 30 seconds, but 30 seconds is your soundbite, right? Because
sure,
the camera's
yeah.
watching. So do you find that when the cameras are off, people behave differently?
Yeah, it used to be said by somebody famous, although I don't remember whom, that, you know, Congress in session is Congress, you know, doing politics, and Congress in committee is Congress at work. Sort of saying the floor is kind of meaningless, but committees, you really do get work done. Well, I don't even know if that's true anymore. I would tweak that adage to say Congress in front of, you know, cameras is Congress at play, and Congress, you know, it, on their own, real people trying to work through issues, is more Congress at work. Now, I'm a big proponent of transparency, so it kind of hurts me to say that.
Right.
But I would tell you the informal conversations we have where you can just say, come on, Lori, really? You won't go for 7? Like, you'll walk away from the table if you don't get, you know, 8. 7? You can't even give us 7. Those are the way you cut deal, whether you're buying a boat or whether you're trying to figure out, you know, if parents disagree about something with a child's education. I mean, you got to be willing to come together to find a solution. And so I would say people are a little better behaved when they're talking person to person, but there's still high levels of polarization.
Tom Daschle and Trent Lott wrote a book together.
Yeah.
They really talked about that. You know, they had to sort of sneak over to each other to even get together, because the political cost for getting together with each other was all of a sudden incredibly, incredibly high. That's not the experience you're having, because you're working across the aisle on a lot of things intentionally. Tell me a little bit about what you sort of, I'm still on the topic of impeachment, what do you admire about some of the moderate Democrats who have decided now is the time, this phone call is the thing that we need, you know, this is important and here's why. What do you sort of admire about their position as they've really changed their minds from the, you know, after the phone call?
Yes. And I would use as a dropping off point, and we can come back to impeachment, but I would use humanitarian aid for the border as a time when I really think they showed some profiles and courage. So the situation was typical DC situation. You know, the Senate had their version of $4.5 billion of humanitarian aid to the border. The House had their version. And there was going to be some fight, and we were getting ready to go work in the district for a couple of weeks. This aid was needed. The White House had begged for it. The Senate Democrats or Republicans had gotten together, because that's often how the Senate works. The House Republicans were more a fan of the Senate package. But Speaker Pelosi really felt like, gosh darn it, no, we're half of the equation here. The House is going to get its package through. And Speaker Pelosi is very formidable. She's not used to losing. But this is the last day before we were going to cut loose for 2 weeks. Again, working in the district, but not taking votes. And the moderate Democrats said, this is too important to let standard DC politics win the day. So they publicly announced 24 of them that they were supportive. They wanted to join with the House Republicans, the Senate, and the White House against the Speaker's package for the Senate package. And that 24 with enough votes to scuttle her package. And I'm sure she was furious. And I'm sure that politically, those 24 group of more moderate freshmen received nothing out of that, right? There's no big donor who cares about that much as humanitarian aid at the border, right? This is an issue we all care about as humans, but it doesn't motivate that many people to change their voting decisions or their giving decisions. They did it because it's the right thing to do. But I'm sure they're still paying some prices. And so when you look at impeachment, no matter whether somebody voted yes or no, there is a tremendous political cost to be paid regardless. I mean, there are lots of my independent Democrat friends that just says, you know, I'll never vote for you again. And, you know, had I voted differently, there'd be a different constituency that would say that.
Right.
And so.
So you think you lost votes by voting?
Oh,
no.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. You know,
you would have lost votes by voting.
Either way.
Yes, but there were votes that you lost. Yeah.
Yeah. There's no question in my mind. I have too many people who've just said that that's the case.
Well, you've got an opponent, and this is happening to your colleague, your Republican colleague, who sort of, you know, became, I'm forgetting her name, Elise.
Oh, Stefanik. Yes.
So she has an opponent that all of a sudden is getting outside
raised
donations.
$1 million in a weekend.
Yeah. Just because of how vocal she's been supporting the president during. So this could, in theory, happen in South Dakota, less likely than in her district. But there is a political cost for you potentially.
Sure. Well, and Elise Stefanik's district is almost as Republican as this one. And Elise is an outstanding man, really hard worker, very common sense, you know, a real expert on national security policy and on education issues, very highly regarded. But it wasn't like that $1 million that her opponent received in the weekend came from upstate New York. I mean, it came from across the country. I mean, there is nothing.
Mark Hamill donated, I think.
Well, there we go,
so
right?
There was a lot of that, a lot of people just saw her and heard her and said, we can defeat her.
I mean, that absolutely could happen to me. I mean, her district is only a couple of points less Republican than this one. But how do you, I mean, I can't compete with millions of dollars of out of district monies. And so
But more than 90% of your donations are coming from right here in South Dakota, right?
They are.
Do I understand that correctly?
Yeah, yeah, that's right. Although, you know, I mean, you're talking about it's hundreds of thousands of dollars in a year. It's not a million over a weekend.
Right.
And so when Mark Hamill and other famous people who have lots of money decide that they want to take you out, someday it might just be my day. And maybe I'll be looking for a different job. But that's why people get so uptight about, well, what's the politically popular thing to do? Every one of these votes is going to irritate somebody. And so over a career, you're going to collect a lot of barnacles on the hull of that ship. So don't imagine an environment where you, that hull can be clean and everybody will love you. They won't. So instead, have the ship pointed in the right direction, just understanding there'll be barnacles regardless.
And that takes us back to that 30 seconds that you have. And I think this is a useful lesson for, you know, school children to business leaders, that 30 seconds, you have to think about your own integrity and what you're going to say. Because if you're worrying about, if I say this, this will happen. If I say this, my party might think this. You're going to lose your mind and you're not going to say anything of value. It's an integrity moment for you.
Well, I don't think we get to run TV ads and give speeches to elementary schools about how terrible bullying is and how important it is to work together and America's great and we built America together. And then the very next day go on the floor and call, you know, fellow Americans traitors because they happen to disagree on one policy topic or another. I mean, if we want to have a country that knows how to get things done, at some point our rhetoric can't attack that very value.
I think voters are ready for that.
Well, what I'm hearing, so.
And maybe it's just from this chair and the work that I do, that when I'm out in the, you know, in the community, in the world, people want to know what we agree on more and more. It feels to me like there's a tipping point where people are exhausted from the rancor and they really want people to stand up and say, let's figure out how to work together. And they want they want the USMCA. We know that.
If people, you know, and I hate to give, you know, all of your listeners an assignment, right? Because, Lord knows I've got a lot I need to work on. But if we want an environment that focuses more on meat and potatoes and working together and facts rather than kind of political rhetoric, we need to invest in that. We need to invest in media outlets that value objectivity. We need to invest, I'm not talking about dollars, I'm talking about emotionally and supporting them with words, you know, politicians and other institutions that value finding common ground. As it is, if I put something more partisan out on Facebook, it will get many, many, many times more engagement than if I talk about me helping to fund an important Lakota language program. Meat and potatoes does not sell as good as the filet mignon, and that's sexier.
Let's talk about what comes after, because immediately after impeachment passes the House, then we see what seems on the outside like a bit of a flurry of bipartisan activity, and we see the passage of USMCA, and you're toasting it on Twitter with your, corn cup? I don't know, something from Mitchell, saying, you know, like this is, you and I have talked about USMCA before. Again, country of origin labeling isn't in it. Not everybody's happy with it. It is not a perfect deal. So two questions. One, how important for South Dakotans, especially in the ag industry and beyond, was the passage of USMCA to end the year with that win?
Yeah, it is really big. You know, because I like to focus on the positive, I talked exclusively in my floor comments and in my public comments about, oh, this is a great win for South Dakota. I mean, if I was in a little darker mood, I would have said the only reason that this wasn't done back in July is that we were holding this to try to put some frosting on what some people is going to think is a pretty sour cake of impeachment, right? This was purposefully planned to give, you know, some people who voted for impeachment something positive to talk about, right? Yeah. And that is unfortunate. I mean, so it's hard for me to celebrate the flurry of bipartisan victories when all we did is take 10 things that we should have gotten done in the middle of the year and ended up getting 4 of them done, you know, at midnight. But that being said, it is really a big deal for South Dakota. There are some people tell you, oh, this is just NAFTA 2.0. Well, that might be, but no independent third-party analyst I've heard from agrees. Their numbers on the low end are 176,000 new jobs. Their numbers on the low end are $2 billion of new ag exports to Canada and Mexico. And their numbers on the low end are $68 billion of new GDP growth. This is a pretty big deal. And particularly for South Dakotans who are in wheat or wine or dairy or poultry, this is a big, big deal for them.
All right. Country of origin labeling. Mm-hmm. Still something that is important to you?
Yeah, I mean, greater transparency is, I think, really, I think the consumers deserve that. I feel a little bad. Politics, really, there were some people who were trying to slow down USMCA. And so a group of my colleagues, who I don't even know care all that much about meat transparency, sent out a letter saying, we need a COOL in USMCA. Well, the reality is that deal had already been cut. I mean, the administration has been done with their negotiations with Canada and Mexico for a year. You can do some things in side agreements. Like a lot of this labor enforcement are in side agreements. They didn't renegotiate the guts of USMCA. And so it was not possible, as much as some of us would have liked greater transparency, it was not possible a year after the deal had been cut and inked to come in and institute country of origin labeling into that deal. It was never seriously a topic of conversation between Speaker Pelosi and Bob Lighthizer, the president's negotiator. It was never seriously a topic of debate within the Senate. It was more political smokescreen, I think, to try to get some of the American ranchers, friends of mine, to try to have a little bit of a drag on USMCA that is not perfect, but you know, it was not possible for those of us who if we would have bled and died and sweat for it to get COOL in that in the last couple of months.
Is it something that you're looking at in the future?
It's going to be very difficult to get that done. The right mechanism to get that done is in an international trade agreement. And USMCA is not an altogether bad thing to get it done. But as Bob Lighthizer told me, he's the U.S. Trade Representative, listen, you walk into these negotiations with 1,000 things you want. You're going to walk out, if you're lucky, with 600. And that means there are 400, you know, orphaned values, that's just how it works. And so, you know, I had a Republican colleague in Florida who voted against it because it didn't do quite enough for fruit. And, you know, I think that was the wrong vote for him. I think the fact that it's going to add 176,000 jobs, including, I'm sure, thousands in Florida, that shouldn't cause him to vote no just because Cherries didn't get exactly what Cherries, you know, wanted out of that deal. I mean, all of these big deals, all of these big bills, they're manure sandwiches, right? I mean, there's a lot in them that is tough to swallow. But for any of us who've tried to run a nonprofit or run a business or been on a church board or been married, we understand about, you know, cutting a deal that's as good as it's got to be, maybe not as good as you want it to be.
Some of the other activity, National Defense Authorization Act, another big, up close to a deadline.
Yes.
Sort of a last minute, I shouldn't say last minute, but, you know, could have been done earlier. How would you phrase it? Yeah.
Yeah. And so this sets basically the strategy for our government's military over the course of the next year. Yeah. Almost always highly bipartisan. It was less bipartisan this time, but that's probably an inevitable outcropping of the era we're in. I will hear a lot of people say, oh, we don't know when any of, you know, our delegation does it out in D.C. And I would just tell you, it's because most people don't have time to go read the 2,000 page bill. But if you go read things like the National Defense Authorizing Act, there are John Thune provisions, Mike Rounds provisions, there are Dusty Johnson provisions in that bill. I mean, the way that we acquire new defense systems is different today than it was last year because I worked hard to improve the way we acquire these defense systems. And they doesn't lead the 6 o'clock news, but I would say South Dakotans should feel good that their delegation, and it's not just because it's this delegation, when we had Stephanie and Tim and Tom, they were working their butts off too. We are making a difference in how these bills get put together.
Tell me why that was important to you. Tell me more about those defense systems.
Well, we need to have, you know, the best and most advanced military in the world. We spend as much as the next 9 countries combined. And there are times we don't get very good value for that because there is a bloated acquisition bureaucracy, both within the private sector that builds this stuff as well as within government. And there are times when we need to be a little more nimble in how we go out and acquire these new systems. We want to have safeguards. We want to make sure the taxpayers' dollars are being spent well. But the way some of these billion-dollar decisions are made today shouldn't bring great pride to anybody. And it's a modest improvement, our bill that we got worked into the NDAA, but I do think it provides for systems that are of a certain size and smaller, a more streamlined approach toward making sure that we can get, you know, the right technology in the right hands.
One of the things the Democrats did not get but wanted in that authorization was a few more checks on presidential power to, you know, for Saudi Arabia and the war against Yemen, and in you know, seeking authorization from Congress about any military action in Iran. talk just broadly, if you will, about that balance of power as you see it. Congress's role, you know, generically speaking, and then the president's role, generically speaking. Do you feel that there is, you know, there's too much strength in the Washington, in the White House for some of those decisions? And if so, how do you correct it? Because it always feels so partisan.
Yes. And yes. So first, I do think that, and this is not unique to President Trump, but certainly over the course of the last 30 years, we've seen more and more of an imperial presidency. Congress deserves more than its fair share of blame for that, insofar as we have been unable to make important decisions. We get politically locked up, analysis paralysis, something's got to get done. And so you get presidents who fill the void. Now, I have been openly critical of, you know, at least the last three presidents when they've been willing to do that. I mean, when President Obama stood up and said, okay, Republican Congress, you won't act. Well, I've got a pen and I've got a cell phone and I'll run this country. Well, that, even if you were a big supporter of President Obama, should have given you a little shiver down your spine that the checks and balances that was so carefully envisioned and crafted by our founders was being cast aside for political expediency. And, you know, that desire to just go get it done, you know, was not unique to President Obama, and it didn't end with him. And so there have been times, you know, when I think the president, in an attempt to try to get something done, has wanted to try to sideline Congress. And again, he doesn't deserve as much of the blame as Congress does for that. But we don't need any more power centralized in the hands of one person. Congress needs to get better at making big decisions. Mm.
And it won't end with President Trump.
It won't. I am enough of a student of history where I understand that there are times when the fever does break, right? I mean, we had a time when, you know, vice presidents, you know, killed secretaries of the Treasury in duels. We had times where, you know, we sent to war 3 million of our countrymen to battle, you know, others of those 3 million countrymen, and hundreds of thousands were slaughtered. We had times during the 60s where it seemed like we couldn't keep a political leader alive because of assassinations. When we were beating students in the street or at Kent State, they were being shot by our own government. And so I am, you know, you never quite know when a more peaceful, more thoughtful time will break out. And so I am hopeful that Congress can get its act together, and that if we start to make bigger decisions, that we'll get more of an appropriate balance.
You never know when a more peaceful and thoughtful time will break out. That's
right.
Super quotable.
Well, yeah. It's probably not going to be this week. I know that.
On the National Defense Authorization Act, at the same time, we have the Washington Post's Afghanistan papers, and we're seeing and hearing for the first time just how broken some of the strategy was. You know, many people would say this isn't the first awareness that we had, but one of the main questions seems to be, did the U.S. government mislead America about the progress of the war in Afghanistan over the past 18 years to make us think that things were going better than they were? Some people say, yes, this is misleading. Others are saying, you know, those military commanders were optimistic. They're go-getters. They were kind of misled themselves. What's your take early on in the Afghanistan papers and the learning report? What are you learning from it?
Well, it was deeply disturbing, and this is going to seem like I'm pandering to a professional journalist, but for me, it is not that we need any more evidence, but it's pretty stark evidence of why we need an even more robust independent media than we have. You know, clearly the economics of how do you sell. People are hungrier for information than they've ever been, but they're not particularly inclined to pay for it. That makes the business case for how to have robust fact-gathering institutions a lot tougher to figure out. And there is a lot of political pandering that goes into trying to delegitimize the media. And they say something we don't like. And granted, there are lots of outlets out there that I don't think are as responsible today as they were 20 years ago. And they are, to a certain extent, some of them just responding to, again, these sometimes perverse incentives we get from the marketplace. It's kind of easy to blame Congress or blame the media. But at some point, you know, in general, the media gives people what they want, right? What drives clicks. And I try to hold them to a higher standard, but I really understand why that is. And you don't get that kind of disclosure without a large news organization with the resources, the persistence, and the independence to go make lots of very powerful people super uncomfortable. And listen, I spent 12 years in state government. I think by and large, people in state government are super honest and super hardworking. And we, at least when I was around, made plenty of mistakes. And it was going to be a lot better. We were a lot more likely to learn of those mistakes if we were held accountable for them by the voters, who only would have known about them because of the media. And so as I've seen more and more outlets pull journalists out of peer because of economic realities, that has saddened me, even while I was chief of staff, even while they were annoying me on a daily basis with their reporting. I knew that that was not good for the citizens. And so the Afghanistan papers, yes, it is super important for what they say about Afghanistan and about political leaders misleading themselves and others. But to me, an even bigger history is how do we come together to finance robust, independent, non-governmental reporting agencies.
Right. Let's close with prescription drugs, because the Democrats in the House have their plan. Nancy Pelosi mm-hmm. has her plan. Republicans have another plan. There's another plan in the Senate. Mm-hmm. And everybody agrees on one thing, and that is it's an issue that has to be addressed. It's incredibly important to voters in 2020, but beyond that, it's incredibly important to people day to day. Tell me a little bit about your plan and why you think that it is an effective policy.
Sure. And I'm not it's not like I just wake up one day and say, well, people are uncomfortable with what they're paying for prescription drugs, so that means we need a governmental solution, right? I mean, I don't believe in price fixing. In general, people feel like they pay too much for everything, right? For gas, for housing, for sure. A new jacket. I mean, that in and of itself isn't a reason to change government's approach. The problem is we pay so much less than everybody else. I mean, those companies should have an opportunity to earn a profit. That's what makes this world work. They should have the resources they need to invest in research and development. I don't begrudge them their profits, and I don't begrudge them their R&D budgets. But the totality of those dollars come from the United States of America. Most of the rest of the world is paying basically at cost it costs those drugs to be made. And that is not fair. They are free riding off the generosity of the American people. And I think it is time to come to an end. And there are provisions that are just indefensible. I'll give you one example that my bill would attack. So right now, if you are an incumbent drug manufacturer, even if you're outside of your 10-year patent protection period, because we need to give you 10 years to make pretty big money, because otherwise you never would have invested the money to make the drug in the first place. It costs on average $1 billion to go develop a new drug. And on average, only 1 in 12 ever make it to market. So you got to make money. I get it. But it is legal in the pharmaceutical industry, even though it's not legal anywhere else, for you to pay a generic competitor to keep their cheap generic off the market. It's a pay for delay that is absolutely indefensible. And you couldn't do that in a gas station, right? You couldn't do that in a grocery store. That's collusion. That's illegal. And so there are some things that have very broad bipartisan support, and I'm really hopeful that in the new year, the speaker's plan was far more partisan. It's not going anywhere in the Senate. I'm hopeful that we're going to come together, pass H.R. 19, the bill I introduced with 100 of my colleagues. It will pass the Senate, and the president will sign it into law.
And we could bring many people to tell their stories about the cost of prescriptions. And I've liked to share this story with people as my brother is going through a cancer battle. He stays alive for 6 more months for another year, and there's a new medication waiting for him. And so it is not nothing that we need the innovation in drug development, because there are individual lives who are being saved. I'm not excusing the cost of prescription drugs at all, but it's a nuanced conversation. It's not quite as simple as just saying, you know, we need to get those prices down, because when less drugs are coming to market, that is impacting real people's lives, and those could be impacts that are life and death.
Well, you're exactly right, Lori. And in fact, Europe, which generally gets drugs a little bit later because they don't pay what we do, the cancer survival rate for men over 50 in Europe is 46% lower than the cancer survival rate for men 50 and up in America. Well, we're less healthy. I mean, 60-year-old Americans are a lot heavier than 60-year-old Italians or French, and yet our survival rate is much higher. And it's the fact that you get a little something for what you pay.
What motivates you to go back after? Because it's nice to come home. It's nice to play football with your kids and talk to South Dakotans again. What motivates you to go back and do the people's work in Washington?
Just the idea that, number one, this stuff really matters, and in fact, it matters as much today as it ever has, and that progress. We need it more today. We absolutely has to have, we have to have it. And when I see the kind of impact we were able to get just as a freshman in the minority, moving that prevent plant harvest date that we talked about, that saved some ranchers and farmers in South Dakota. And maybe had a different person been in this job. Maybe had they hired a different staff. Maybe if they didn't have as good a relationship with the Secretary of Ag, maybe that wouldn't have gotten done. And I think there are opportunities for me to be helpful in ways that dealing with the China deal, with these prescription drugs, with HR 19 that I introduced, with some of the issues facing Indian country that we've really had taken an interest in. I don't think I'm perfect, and there are lots of jobs I'd be terrible at, but I really believe that we are in a position and have a skill set that can make a difference that is above and beyond what many of my colleagues can. And I'm going to go try, and we'll find out.
Congressman Dusty Johnson, you've been incredibly generous with your time today, and we appreciate this opportunity.
Thank you. Thanks, Lori.